way to fresh targets, called out in unison, "Apollyon! Apollyon! Apollyon!" "Why would God do this to me?" Chaim whined. "What did I ever do to him? You know me, Cameron. I am not a bad man." "He didn't do this, Dr. Rosenzweig. You did it to yourself." "What did I do that was so wrong? What was my sin?"
"Pride, for one," Buck said, pulling up a chair. He knew there was nothing he could do for his friend but keep him company, but he was past gentility.
"Proud? I am proud?"
"Maybe not intentionally, Doctor, but you've ignored everything Zion has told you about how to connect with God. You have counted on your charm, your own value, your being a good person to carry you through. You get around all the evidence for Jesus being the Messiah by reverting to your educational training, your confidence only in what you can see and hear and feel. How many times have you heard Zion quote Titus chapter 3, verse 5, and Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 to 9? And yet you..." Chaim cried out in pain.
"Quote them to me again, Cameron, would you?"
"Not by works of righteousness which we have done, but according to his mercy he has saved us. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast." Chaim nodded miserably.
"Cameron, this is so painful."
"Sad to say, it will get worse. The Bible says you will want to die and won't be able to commit suicide." Chaim rocked and cried in anguish.
"Would God accept me if I relent only to ease my torture?"
"God knows everything, Doctor, even your heart. If you knew you would still suffer worse and worse for 5 months, regardless of your decision, would you still want him?"
"I don't know," he said. "God forgive me, I don't know."
Buck turned on the radio and found a pirate station broadcasting the preaching of Eli and Moshe from the Wailing Wall. Eli was in the middle of a typically tough message. "You rant and rave against God for the terrible plague that has befallen you. Though you will be the last, you were not the first generation who forced God's loving hand to act in discipline. Hearken unto these words from the ancient days, the Lord God of Israel. I have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city, and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet have ye not returned unto me. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew. When your gardens increased, the palmer worm devoured them. Yet have ye not returned unto me. I have sent among you the pestilence after the manner of Egypt. Your young men have I slain with the sword, yet have ye not returned unto me. I have overthrown some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And ye were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning, yet have ye not returned unto me. Therefore thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. For lo, he that formeth the mountains and createth the wind, and declareth unto man what is his thought, that maketh the morning darkness, and treadeth upon the high places of the earth, the Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. Thus saith the Lord unto the house of Israel, seek ye me, and ye shall live. Ye who turn judgment to wormwood, and leave off righteousness in the earth,
Seek him that maketh the seven stars and Orion, and turneth the shadow of death into the morning, and maketh the day dark with night, that calleth for the waters of the sea, and poureth them out upon the face of the earth. The Lord is his name. Therefore the prudent shall keep silence in that time, for it is an evil time. Seek good, and not evil, that ye may live, and so the Lord, the God of hosts, shall be with you as ye have spoken. Hate the evil, and love the good, and establish judgment in the gate. It may be that the Lord God of hosts will be gracious unto the remnant of Joseph. Though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, for I will not hear the melody of thy vials. But let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. Wow, Buck said.
Please, Cameron, Chaim said. Turn it off, I can take no more.
Buck sat another 2 hours with Chaim, helpless to ease his suffering. The man thrashed and sweated and gasped. When finally he relaxed a moment, he said,
Are you sure about this getting worse and worse until I despair of my life?
Buck nodded.
How do you know?
I believe the Bible.
It says that? In those words?
Buck knew it from memory. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it, he said. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. Chapter 18. During the ensuing 5 months, the demon locusts attacked anyone who didn't have the seal of God on his or her forehead. And for 5 months after that, those among the last bitten still suffered. The starkest picture of the interminable suffering came from Hattie's ordeal at the Tribulation Forces safe house in Mount Prospect, Illinois. Her torment was so great that everyone, Rayford, Zion, Chloe, and Floyd, begged her to give in to Christ. Despite her anguished screams at all hours of the day and night, she stubbornly maintained that she was getting what she deserved and no less. Listening to her around the clock became so stressful to the force that Rayford made an executive decision and moved her to the basement where Ken had lived. As weeks passed, she became a shell of even the unhealthy frame she had been. Rayford felt as if he were visiting a living corpse every time he went down there, and he soon quit going alone. It was too frightening. Doc Charles tried to treat her symptoms, quickly discovering it was futile, and the rest took turns delivering her meals, which were rarely touched. She ate much less than should have been required to keep her alive, but as the Bible predicted, she did not die. It got to where Rayford had to visit Hattie with one of the others, and even then he didn't sleep well afterward. Hattie was skeletal, her dark eyes sunk deep into her head, her lips stretched thin and taut across teeth that now looked too big for her mouth. Eventually she couldn't speak, but communicated by a series of grunts and gestures. Finally she refused to even turn and look when someone came down. Hattie finally forced herself to talk when Chloe somehow located her sister working at an abortion clinic out west. All the other members of Hattie's family had died in various ways before the plague of locusts. Now Hattie spoke to her sister for the first time in months. Nancy had somehow avoided for a few months the sting of a scorpion locust, but now she too was a victim.
"Nancy, you must believe in Jesus,"
Hattie managed, though she spoke as if her mouth was full of sores.
"It's the only answer. He loves you. Do it."
Floyd had overheard Hattie's end of the conversation and asked Rayford and Zion to join him in talking to her, but she was more belligerent than ever.
But it's so obvious you know the truth, Zion said, and the truth shall set you free.
Don't you see I don't want to be free? I only want to stay alive long enough to kill Nikolai, and I will. Then I don't care what happens to me.
But we care, Rayford said.
You'll be all right,
she said, rolling over and turning her back to them. Chloe, getting toward the end of her pregnancy, finally couldn't navigate the stairs. She told Rayford that the prayer of her life now was that Buck would somehow make it home before the baby was born. Zion was busier than ever. He passed on miraculous reports from the 144,000 witnesses who had fanned out to serve as missionaries to every country, not just their own. Stories poured in of obscure tribal groups understanding in their own languages and becoming tribulation saints. Zion wrote to nearly a billion website visitors every day that this was the last period during the end of time when believers would have any semblance of freedom.
Now is the time, my dear brothers and sisters, he wrote. With everyone else vulnerable to the attacks of the locust hordes, they must stay inside or venture out only with bulky protective gear. This is our chance to put into place mechanisms that will allow us to survive when the world system requires its own mark one day. We will be allowed to neither buy nor sell without the mark. And it is a mark that, once taken, seals the fate of the bearer for all time, just as the mark we now bear has sealed us for eternity. I beg of you not to look upon God as mean or capricious when we see the intense suffering of the bite victims. This is all part of his master design to turn people to him so he can demonstrate his love. The scriptures tell us God is ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abundant in kindness. How it must pain him to have to resort to such measures to reach those he loves. It hurts us to see that even those who do receive Christ as a result of this ultimate attention-getter still suffer for the entire 5 months prescribed in biblical prophecy. And yet I believe we are called to see this as a picture of the sad fact that sin and rebellion have their consequences. There are scars. If a victim receives Christ, God has redeemed him, and he stands perfect in heaven's sight. But the effects of sin linger. Oh, dear ones, it thrills my heart to get reports from all over the globe that there are likely more Christ followers now than were raptured. Even nations known for only a minuscule Christian impact in the past are seeing great numbers come to salvation. Of course, we see that evil is also on the rise. The scriptures tell us that those who remain rebellious even in light of this awful plague simply love themselves and their sin too much. Much as the world system tries to downplay it, our society has seen catastrophic rises in drug abuse, sexual immorality, murder, theft, demon worship, and idolatry. Be of good cheer, even in the midst of chaos and plague, loved ones. We know from the Bible that the evil demon king of the abyss is living up to his name, Abaddon in Hebrew and Apollyon in Greek, which means destroyer, in leading the demon locusts on the rampage. But we, as the sealed followers of the Lord God, need not fear, for as it is written, He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. We are of God. He who knows God hears us. He who is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Always test my teaching against the Bible. Read it every day. New believers, and none of us are old, are we, learn the value of the discipline of daily reading and study.
When we see the ugly creatures that have invaded the Earth, it becomes obvious that we, too, must go to war. Finally, my brethren, with the Apostle Paul, I urge you to be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel. Until next we interact through this miracle of technology the Lord has used to build a mighty church against all odds, I remain your servant and his, Zion ben Judah. Buck knew that Yaakov and Hannalore and Stefan had grown in their faith when they insisted on moving into the Rosenzweig estate and caring for Chaim and Jonas for several months. They brought with them Hannalore's mother, who had received Christ the day the locusts attacked. Even in her suffering, she read and studied and prayed, often pleading with Chaim and Jonas to also come to Christ. Even after Jonas did, Chaim remained resolute. Unable to find a commercial flight that had a full crew, Buck desperately searched among the saints to find someone who might charter him back to the States for the birth of his child. At wit's end, he tried calling Mac in New Babylon, but was unable to get through. He tried emailing him a heavily coded message, and an hour later received a lengthy reply. "I'm still looking forward to meeting you, Mr. Williams. Of course, your father-in-law has told me all about you, but don't worry, I didn't believe a word of it. How do you like the email system David has set me up with here? He's built into it all the safeguards you could imagine. If someone walked in on me right now, they wouldn't be able to read what I've just written. I gather you need a charter flight out of there. Try Abdullah Smith in Jordan. The name looks weird, but he has his reasons. And he is a believer. Mention my name and he'll charge you double. Just kidding. If he can handle the job, he'll take care of you. I'll copy this to your people so they'll know what's going on here. David Hasid and I had to fake locust stings to keep from revealing ourselves. In the process, we discovered several other clandestine believers in the ranks here. Carpathia and Leon are quarantined in a fallout shelter that has served to keep out the locusts too, though almost everyone else, including the 10 rulers and even Peter II, have been stung and are suffering. When you see Carpathia on the news telling everyone that the stories of poisonous bites are exaggerated while he sits there with a locust on his shoulder as a pet, don't believe it. It's a trick of photographic technology. Of course, the real things probably wouldn't bite Nikolai or Leon out of professional courtesy. A few of us believers have been able to pretend we're simply recuperating more quickly so we don't lie around the infirmary 24 hours a day listening to the agony. Carpathia has sent me on some missions of mercy, delivering aid to some of the worst-off rulers. What he doesn't know is that David has picked up clandestine shipments of literature, copies of Zion's studies in different languages, and has jammed the cargo hold of the Condor 216 with them. Believers, wherever I go, unload and distribute them. Word has gotten back to Leon that all this Christian literature is flooding the globe, and he's furious about it. So is Peter II. I hope someday they both find out how it was transported, but not yet. Pray for us. We're your eyes and ears in New Babylon, and light as I try to make it all sound, we're in very precarious positions. Subversives are punished by death here. Two close members of Peter Matthews's staff were executed for mentioning to global community personnel something Peter thought was private. Carpathia heard about the executions and sent him a note of congratulations. Of course, Peter is on Nikolai's hit list, or at least for sure on Leon's. Leon believes there's no need for any religion, because we have His Excellency the Potentate to worship. I say that with irony, but Leon is dead serious. David was in the room when Leon suggested passing a law that people have to bow in Nikolai's presence. That may be the end of me. The believers here cannot meet for fear of suspicion and detection, but we encourage each other in subtle ways. Fortunately, David has been elevated to a position that puts him on a level close to the senior pilot, yours truly, so we're expected to interact a lot. We love the late Ken Ritz's idea for the Believer's Commodity Co-op, for lack of a better handle, and we think your wife will make an absolutely smashing CEO. You know who her direct competition will be, of course. Carpathia himself is personally, really, taking charge of global commerce, effective immediately. You heard it here first. He wants those 10 kings in his hip pocket, doesn't he? You know, Mr. Williams, I heard something on the Condor a few days before the locusts attacked that proved one of Dr. Benjuda's points. Remember when he wrote that this period is not just a grand war between good and evil, but also a war between evil and evil? I think his point was that we were to love each other and make sure the crises don't turn us on each other and spur fights between good and good. But anyway, Matthews and Saint Nick and the ever-present Leon My Whole Fortunato is tied to you, Excellency, are aboard the Condor 216. I finally figured out the significance of Carpathia's obsession with that number, by the way. Well, actually, David told me. He thought everybody knew. Your quiz for the week. So on the plane, Noel Matthews is really putting the screws to Carpathia. He's demanding this and urging that and begging for more share of the taxes for all the wonderful stuff Enigma Babylon is going to do for the global community. Nikolai is yesing him and ahaying him to beat the band. Matthews takes a bathroom break, and Nikolai tells Fortunato, "If you don't have him hit, I'll do the job myself." Of course, Leon tells him, "He's outlived his usefulness, and I'm working on it." Well, didn't mean to ramble, but with all the afflicted here, I've got more alone time than I'll probably ever have again. All the best with the little one. We'll pray you get home in time and that Mama is up and around in time to get back to work and make a parent out of you. Greet everyone for me. In the name of Christ, Mac M. Still grieving the loss of Ken Ritz, missing his interaction with Mac McCollum, and reeling from the attempted infiltration of the bumbling Ernie, Rayford took his time getting to know T.M. Delante. While Ernie and the irrepressible Beau were ensconced at Arthur Young Memorial Hospital in Palatine, Rayford made several trips to the Palwaukee Airport to sift through Ken's things. As often as not, he'd see T. They shared life stories over a couple of lunches, and Rayford knew they had taken a step toward potential friendship when he mustered the courage to ask, "What does TM stand for?" T gave him a you-had-to-ask-didn't-you look. "If I wanted people to know that, I wouldn't have resorted to initials. Sorry, just wondered why you go by T, that's all. I've got a crummy first name, what can I tell you? My mother was African-American and my father Scotch-Irish, heavy on the Scotch, sad to say. She named me after an old schoolteacher of hers. Tyrola made a good last name, but if you were hung with that moniker, what would you go by?" "I'd go by a ticket out of town, T. Sorry I asked. Middle name wasn't an option?"
Mark. Rayford shrugged. What's wrong with that? Nothing, except do I look like a Mark? Admit it, I look like a T.
Tyrola Mark Delaney was the only member of his small church to be left behind at the rapture. I was suicidal, he said, and I can't say I've had much fun even since I finally got right with God. Lost a wife of 14 years and 6 kids, my whole extended family, friends, church people, everybody. Rayford asked whom he met with now.
There are about 30 believers in my neighborhood. More all the time. Neighborhood is overstating it, of course. We're all living in our original homes, but they're worthless. Just happen to not fall over, so they're living spaces.
After a few meetings, Rayford and T finally got around to the subject of Ken and Paul Walkie and Bo and Ernie. It turned out that T was the major owner of the airport, having bought it from the county a couple of years before the rapture.
Never made much money at it. Low margin, but it was turning. Ken and several other regulars flew out of here. Ken lived here, as you know, until the earthquake when he moved in with you guys.
Bo was the only son of a wealthy investor who owned 5% of the business, but who had died in a car wreck when the rapture took drivers from cars in front and in back of his.
In the ensuing chaos, Bo shows up as the sole heir, trying to act like a board member and a boss. I humored him until he brought Ernie on. I fought it at first. He was a 19-year-old who had dropped out of school when he was 14, but reputed to be a natural mechanic. Well, it turned out he was, and he helped a lot around here. I only put it together the day of the locust attack that Ernie and Bo had a scheme going.
Why would they have wanted Ernie to infiltrate our group?
Rumor was that Ken had a lot of money. Ernie was trying, I think, to get in good with him. He and Bo would have run some scam on him and tried to cash in. When Ken was killed, they went into high gear. You saw the sad result of that comical effort.
Rayford studied T, trying to decide whether to ask what he thought of the rumors about Ken's wealth. He decided not to pursue it yet. But T made the question moot.
The rumors were true, you know.
As a matter of fact, I do know, Rayford said. How did you know?
Ken really wanted to buy the airport, and I really wanted to sell it. That was my hope all along. But now I had a different motive. Rebuilding it after the earthquake really strapped me, and I needed to cash out. I wanted to pour a little money into our tiny congregation and see if we couldn't accomplish something for God in the few years we have left. I asked Ken if he could afford market value for the airport, and he assured me he could.
Did he happen to say where he banked?
T smiled. We're still feeling each other out, aren't we? Still playing cat and mouse.
I was just wondering, Rayford said.
Yes, I think we're both up to speed.
What do you think should be done with Ken's assets, T?
Used for God, every last dime. That's what he would have wanted.
I agree. Does that money belong to anyone else, legally, I mean?
Nope.
And you have access to it?
You want to dig with me, Rayford?
I don't know. What are you paying?
Unless Ken told you you could have it, I believe rightfully it's mine. It was left on my property. I'm not sure where, and I'm not sure how much, but I'd sure like to get at it before Bo and Ernie recuperate.
Rayford nodded. Your little church can make use of all that?
Like I said, we want to see if we can do something significant. We wouldn't build a church or fix up our homes.
Any inkling how much you're talking about? Rayford said.
Maybe over $1 million.
Would it surprise you to know it's probably 5 times that?
Are we negotiating, Rayford? You want some of this, think you're entitled to it? What?
Rayford shook his head.
I'd like to be able to buy his planes. I have no claim on his money or anything else.
I'll tell you what, T said. If there's half as much money as you think there is, I'll give you his planes. How much for the Gulfstream?
If there's as much as you say there is, you can have that one, too. And can I fly out of here? You can house 'em, keep 'em up, and live here with 'em if you want. And may a Jordanian fly my son-in-law in here within 24 hours, no questions asked? You got it, brother.
Rayford broached the subject of a world commodity co-op among believers, coordinated out of the Tribulation Force safe house. Any interest in getting behind that? Delivering, running charters, that type of thing?
Now that I could get excited about, T said. My little band of believers, too, I'll bet.
Buck met Abdullah Smith in an outdoor cafe run by a young woman on the tail end of her recuperative season. Abdullah was as secretive and quiet as just about anyone Buck had ever met, but he had a clear mark on his forehead and was healthy. He embraced Buck with vigor, despite being a laconic conversationalist.
The name McCullum is all I need to hear, sir. We are brothers, the three of us. I fly, you pay, nothing more need be said.
And it wasn't, at least by Abdullah. Buck told him he was making one last social call and would meet him at the airport in Amman at 6 that evening. I would appreciate a stop in northern Greece and then straight to the Chicago area. Abdullah nodded. The streets of Jerusalem were largely deserted. Buck had never grown used to the sobbing and howling he heard on every corner. It seemed many suffered in every household. He heard that thousands in Jerusalem had slit their wrists, tried to hang themselves, drank poison, stuck their heads in gas ovens, put plastic bags over their heads, sat in garages with cars running, even jumped in front of trains and leapt off buildings. They were severely injured, of course, and some were left looking like slabs of butchered meat. But no one died. They just lived in torment. Buck found Rosenzweig's home a little quieter, but even Chaim begged to be put out of his misery. Yakov reported that Chaim had taken no nourishment, none, for more than a week. He was trying to starve himself to death or develop a fatal case of dehydration. He looked terrible, emaciated and wan. Jonas and Yakov's mother-in-law were more stoic. Though clearly suffering, they did what they could to help themselves. They slept, they ate, they got up and around. They tried medication, though it seemed to make no difference. The point was in trying. They looked forward to the day they would be free from the effects of the sting. Jonas, in particular, was childlike in his excitement over reading the Bible with Yakov and having Zion ben Judah's daily cyberspace message read to him. Chaim merely wanted to die. Buck sat on his bed until the old man cried out in agony, "Everything hurts, Cameron. If you cared a whit about me, you would free me from this misery. Have compassion. Do the right thing. God will forgive you." "You're asking the impossible, and I wouldn't do it anyway. I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't give you every opportunity to believe."
"Let me die."
"Chaim, I do not understand you. I really don't. You know the truth. Your suffering will be over in several weeks, and..."
"I will never survive that long."
"And you'll have something to live for." Chaim was silent and still for a long time, as if peace had come over him. But it had not.
"To tell you the truth, my young friend, I don't understand either. I confess I want to come to Christ, but a battle rages within me, and I simply cannot."
"You can."
"I cannot."
"Not being able to is not the problem, is it, doctor?" Chaim shook his head miserably.
"I will not."
"And you deny my charge that your pride keeps you from God?"
"I admit it now. It is my pride. But it's there and it's real. A man cannot become what he is not."
"Oh, that's where you're wrong, Chaim." Paul, who had been an Orthodox Jew, wrote, "If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation.
old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new." Chaim thrashed painfully for several minutes, but he said nothing. To Buck, that was progress.
"Chaim," he said softly,
"leave me alone, Cameron.
I'll be praying for you."
"You'll be wasting your time."
"Never. I love you, Chaim. We all do. God most of all."
"If God loved me, he would let me die."
"Not until you belong to him."
"That will never happen."
Famous last words. "Goodbye, friend. I'll look forward to seeing you again."
Chapter 19. Rayford loved his daughter with all that was in him. He always had. It wasn't just because she was the only family he had left. He had loved Raimi, too, and still missed him terribly. Losing two wives in fewer than 3 years was a blow he knew would be with him until Jesus came again. But his relationship with Chloe had always been special. They'd had their moments, of course, when she was going through the process of breaking away from the family and becoming an independent young woman, yet she was so much like him. That had made it difficult for her to believe that God was behind the disappearances in the first place. Flattered that she took after him, and yet afraid her practicality might forever keep her from Christ, Rayford had agonized over her. The greatest day of his life, excluding when he himself became a believer, was when Chloe made her decision. He was thrilled when she and Buck married, despite the 10-year difference. He didn't know what he thought when he heard they were expecting and that he would be a grandfather with fewer than 5 years left on earth. But seeing Chloe in the full bloom of her pregnancy, he was transported. He remembered Irene, despite difficult pregnancies, looking radiant the further she progressed and, yes, the bigger she got. He had read all the books, knew the pitfalls. Rayford understood that Irene wouldn't believe him when he said she was most beautiful when she was very pregnant. She had said the same things Chloe was saying now, that she felt like a cow, a barn, a barge. She hated the swollen joints, the sore back, the shortness of breath, the lack of mobility.
"In a way, I'm glad Buck is stuck in Israel," she said. "I mean, I want him back, and I want him back now, but he's going to think I've doubled in size."
Rayford took the occasion to sit with Chloe. "Sweetheart," he said, "indulge me. It may be politically incorrect to say that you're doing what you were meant to do. I know you're more than a baby-making machine and that you have incredible things to offer this world. You made an impact even before the rapture, but since, you've been a soldier. You're going to make the World Commodity Co-op a lifesaver for millions of saints. But you need to do me a favor and stop bemoaning what this pregnancy is doing to your body."
"I know, Daddy," she said, "but it's just that I'm so..."
"Beautiful," he said. "Absolutely beautiful." He said it with such feeling that it seemed to shut her up. She looked different, of course. Nothing was the same. With only a few weeks until her due date, she was full-faced and ponderous. But he could still detect his little girl there, his Chloe, when she had been a toddler, full of life and curiosity.
"I'm frustrated for Buck that he can't see you like this."
"Now don't look at me like that. I mean it. He'll find you so lovely, and believe it or not, he'll find you attractive, too. You're not the first mom-to-be who equates pregnancy with being overweight. Husbands don't think that way. He'll see you the way I saw your mother when she was carrying you. He'll be overcome with the knowledge that you're carrying his and your child."
Chloe seemed to appreciate the pep talk.
"I'm really stressed about him coming home," she said. "I know he's leaving Israel at 6 their time, but who knows how long he'll be in Greece?"
"Not long. He wants to get home."
"And it being a charter, they'll keep moving, I think. I wish I could meet him at the airport."
Doc says you shouldn't.
Ride in the car, especially on these roads, I know. I don't really want to endure that. But Buck and I have been apart so long. And as much as we worry about bringing a baby into the world at this time in history, we've both grown so attached to this child already that we can't wait to meet him or her.
I can't wait to be a grandfather, Rayford said. I've been praying for this child since I knew it existed. I just worry that life is going to be so hard for all of us that I won't get the opportunity to be the kind of grandpa I want to be.
You'll be great. I'm glad you're not still flying for Carpathia. I wouldn't want to worry about you all the time.
Rayford stood and looked out the window. The morning sun was harsh. I'm getting back into the war, he said.
What does that mean?
Well, I blame it on you. You've taken Ken's idea so far that it's going to give me a full-time job. I'm going to be flying almost as much as when I was with Pan Con.
For the co-op?
He nodded. I've told you about T.
Uh-huh.
We're going to run the airlift operation out of Pawlawki. I'll be flying all over the world. If those fishermen in the Bering Strait are as successful as you seem to think they'll be, I'll have enough business up there to last till the glorious appearing. Floyd Charles knocked on the door jamb. Time for a little checkup. You want Dad to wait outside?
What are we doing?
Chloe said. Just checking heartbeats, yours and Junior's.
He can stay. Can he listen?
Sure.
Floyd took Chloe's pulse first, then listened to her heart with his stethoscope.
He spread lubricating jelly on her protruding belly and used a battery-powered monitor to amplify the liquid sounds of the fetal heartbeat. Rayford fought tears, and Chloe beamed. Sounds like a big boy to me, Doc Charles said.
As he finished up, Chloe asked, Everything still fine?
No major problems, he said. Rayford glanced at Floyd. He wasn't as light as usual. He hadn't even smiled when he joked about her having a boy. She didn't want to know the sex of the baby, and he had never tested to find out.
How about other than major problems, Floyd? She said, her voice flat. You usually say everything's great.
She had spoken exactly what was on Rayford's mind, and his heart sank when Floyd pulled up a chair. You noticed that, did you? He said.
Oh, no, she said.
Floyd put a hand on her shoulder. Chloe, listen to me.
Oh, no.
Chloe, what did I say? I said no major problems, and I meant it. Do you think I would say that if it wasn't true?
So what's the minor problem?
Some reduction in the baby's pulse.
You're kidding, Rayford said.
If I'd had to guess, I would have said it sounded too fast. All fetal pulses are faster than ours, Floyd said. And the reduction is so slight that I hardly gave it a second thought last week.
This has been going on for a week, Chloe said.
Floyd nodded. We're talking about a fraction of a percentage decrease in 6 days. It doesn't have to mean anything.
But if it means anything, Chloe said, what would it mean?
We don't want to see an actual slowdown of the fetal pulse, like 5%, especially 10% or more.
Because?
Because that could mean some threat to viability.
English, doctor, Chloe said.
As the baby gets into position for birth, the umbilical cord could tighten around the chest or the neck.
Do you think that's happening?
No, I'm just watching heart rate, Chloe, that's all.
Is it a possibility?
Anything is a possibility. That's why I'm not listing everything that can go wrong.
If this is so minor, why are you telling me?
For one thing, you asked. I just want to prepare you for a form of treatment should the symptoms persist.
But you said the reduction in rate right now isn't worth worrying about.
Okay, if the symptoms get worse.
What would you do?
At least get you on oxygen for the better part of each day.
I need to stand up a minute, Chloe said. She started to move and Rayford reached to help. Floyd didn't.
Actually, he said, I'd prefer that you take it very easy until I can get out and get you some oxygen tomorrow.
I can't even stand up?
For necessities. If it's just a shift position, try not to.
All right, she said. My dad and I are bottom-line people. Give me the worst-case scenario.
I've dealt with enough pregnant women, especially at this stage of gestation, to know it's not best to dwell on all the negative possibilities.
I'm not pregnant women, Doc. I'm Chloe, and you know me, and you know I'm gonna bug you to death until you tell me the worst case.
All right, he said. I see the oxygen solving the problem. If it doesn't, I'll have you on monitors around the clock to warn of a significant change in fetal pulse. Worst case, we might want to induce labor. It might mean a cesarean section because of the likelihood of an umbilical cord problem.
Chloe fell silent and looked at Rayford. He said,
"You don't like to induce, right?" "Of course not. I used to say nature knows best. That baby comes when he's ready. Now I know that God knows best, but he has also given us brains and miracle medicines and technologies that allow us to do what we need to do when things don't go the way we wish."
Chloe looked uncomfortable. "I need to know one thing, Floyd. Did I contribute to this? Was there something I shouldn't have done or something I should have done differently?"
Floyd shook his head. "I wasn't wild about your going to Israel, and if I never hear again about you running from helicopter to jet, it'll be too soon. But overexertion at that stage of pregnancy would have shown up in different problems."
"Such as?"
"Such as nothing that turned up, so I'm not going to talk about it. How's that? You've already been through all the predictable stuff, convinced you're going to have a monster, convinced the baby has already died, certain your baby doesn't have all its parts. You don't need to worry about stuff you might have caused but didn't. Now, when do you expect Papa?"
"Sometime tonight," she said. "That's all I know."
Abdullah Smith seemed pleased that Buck showed up when he said he would. "I heard you were a man of your word," Buck said, "and wanted to show that I am, too." Abdullah, as usual, did not respond. He grabbed one of Buck's bags and led him briskly toward his plane. Buck tried to guess which one it would be. He passed the prop jobs, knowing they would never get him across the Atlantic, but Abdullah also passed a Lear jet and a brand-new Hegemon, a smaller version of the Concorde and just as fast.
Buck stopped and stared when Abdullah pulled back the plexiglass cockpit shield of what he recognized as an Egyptian fighter jet. It would fly nearly 2,000 miles an hour at very high altitudes, but had to have a shorter-than-usual fuel range. "This is your plane?" Buck said. "Please to board," Abdullah said. "Fuel tank enlarged. Small cargo hold added. Stop in Greece, stop in London, stop in Greenland, stop in Wheeling." Buck was impressed that he knew where he was going. It was clear his hope of stretching out, getting some reading done, even dozing, was not in the cards.
"Passenger must board first," Abdullah said.
Buck climbed in and tried to show that he knew his way around this type of craft after having done a series of articles on ride-alongs with American fighter pilots. That was before the reign of Nikolai Carpathia and the wholesale marketing of such surplus craft to private citizens. Buck was about to strap on his helmet and oxygen mask when Abdullah sighed and said, "Belt." Buck was sitting on it, so much for showing off. He had to stand, as much as one could in that confined space, while Abdullah reached beneath him to retrieve the belt. Once strapped in, he tried to put the helmet on. Again, the pilot had to assist, untangling his straps, twisting the helmet just so, and smacking it on top until it settled into correct and extremely tight position. It pressed against Buck's temples and cheekbones. He started to put the mouthpiece in until Abdullah reminded him, "Not until high altitude."
"Right, I knew that."
Abdullah fit just ahead of him,
giving Buck the feeling they were on a luge, Abdallah's head just inches from Buck's nose. Taking a jet fighter from a staging area out onto the tarmac, into line, and then out onto the runway would have taken up to half an hour in the States. Buck learned that in Amman, the airport was like the street market. No lines or queues. It was first come, first served, and you were on your own. Abdallah sang something into the radio about jet, charter, passenger, cargo, and Greece, all while moving the fighter directly onto the runway. He didn't wait for instructions from ground control. The Amman airport had only recently reopened after rebuilding, and while air traffic was down because of the plague of locusts, several flights were lined up. Two wide bodies sat at the front of the line, followed by a standard jet, a Learjet, and another big plane. Abdallah turned to get Buck's attention and pointed to the fuel gauge, which showed full. Buck gave a thumbs-up sign, which he intended to imply that he felt good about having lots of fuel. Abdallah apparently took it to mean that Buck wanted to get into the air, and now. He taxied quickly around other planes, reached the line of craft cleared and in line for takeoff, and passed them one by one. Buck was speechless. He imagined if the other pilots had horns, they'd have been honking like drivers in traffic do to those who ride the shoulder. As Abdallah passed the second wide body, the first began to roll. Abdallah slipped in behind it, and suddenly he and Buck were next in line. Buck craned his neck to see if emergency vehicles were coming or whether the other planes would just pull ahead and get back in their original order. No scolding came from the tower. As soon as the big jet was well on its way down the runway, Abdallah pulled out. "Edward Zulu Zulu 2-9er taking off, tower," he said into the radio. Buck fully expected someone to come back with, "Just where do you think you're going, young man?" But no one did. 10-4 Abdallah was all he heard. There was no warming up and little building speed. Abdallah drove the fighter to the end of the runway, lined her up, and punched it. Buck's head was driven back and his stomach flattened. He couldn't have leaned forward if he'd wanted to. Clearly breaking every rule of international aviation, Abdallah reached takeoff speed in a few hundred yards and was airborne. He rocketed above and beyond the jet in front of him, and Buck felt as if they were flying straight up. He was pressed back in his seat, staring at clouds. It seemed only minutes later, Abdallah reached the apex of his climb, and just like that, he seemed to throttle back and start his descent. It was like a roller coaster ride, blasting to the peak and then rolling down the other side. Abdallah mashed a button that allowed him to speak directly into Buck's headset. "Amman to Athens, just up and down," he said. "But we're not going to Athens, remember?" Abdallah smacked his helmet. "Ptolemais, right?" "Right." The plane shot straight up again. Abdallah dug through a set of rolled-up maps and said, "No problem." And he was right. Minutes later, he came screaming onto the runway of the small airport. "How long with friends?" he said, taxiing to the fuel pumps. Rayford reassured Chloe, and they agreed they'd rather Floyd tell the truth than sugarcoat it and run into problems later. But after he brought her water, Rayford moved upstairs to talk to Zion. The rabbi welcomed him warmly. "Almost finished with my lesson for today," he said. "I'll transmit it in an hour or so. Anyway, I always have time for you." Rayford told him of the potential complication with the baby. "I will pray," Zion said, "and I would ask you to pray for me as well." "Sure, Zion. Anything specific?" "Well, yes. Frankly, I feel lonely and overwhelmed, and I hate that feeling." "It's sure understandable." "I know. And I have a deep sense of joy, such as we get when we are in fellowship with the Lord. I have told him this, of course, but I would appreciate knowing someone else is praying for me, too." "I'm sure we all do, Zion. I am most blessed to have such a loving family to replace my loss. We have all suffered.
Sometimes it just overtakes me. I knew this locust plague was coming, but I never thought through the ramifications. In many ways, I wish we had been more prepared. Our enemy has been incapacitated for months. Yet while we count on them for so many things like transportation, communications, and the like, this has crippled us, too. I don't know, he said, rising and stretching. I don't expect to find happiness anymore. I am looking forward to the birth of this little one as if it were my own. That will bring a ray of sunshine. And we want you to be another parent to it, Zion. The contrast alone will be sobering, though, won't it? The contrast? This fresh young innocent will not know why Hattie is crying. Won't know of our losses. Won't understand that we live in terror, enemies of the state. And there will be no need to teach the little one of all the despair of the past, as we would if we were raising it to adulthood. By the time this baby is 5 years old, it will already be living in the millennial kingdom with Jesus Christ in control. Imagine. Zion had a way of bringing perspective to everything. Yet Rayford was sobered by the rabbi's angst. Millions around the world expected Dr. Ben-Judah to be their spiritual leader. They had to assume he was at peace with his own mature walk with God. Yet he was a new believer, too. While a great scholar and theologian, he was but a man. Like most others, he had suffered grievously. He still had his days of despair. Rayford began feeling lonely in advance. Floyd would have plenty of doctoring to do in the safe house with a new baby and Hattie still ailing. Buck had told Rayford he looked forward to some modicum of normalcy and permanence so he could make his internet magazine what it needed to be to compete with Carpathia's global community rags. Chloe would be busy with the baby and the details of the commodity co-op, and Hattie, when she finally recuperated, would itch to get out of